Hey there, and welcome to The Play's the Thing, podcast number one. What is a play, and how are plays unique as a narrative art form? My name is Andy Black, and I'm a playwright, and this podcast series is being offered in conjunction with the Play Submissions Helper website. My personal playwriting website is www.andrewblackplaywright.com. And you can find a lot more information about me and my background, plays I've written, my experience, classes I teach, and so forth, if you go to that website. And then the Play Submissions Helper website is www.playsubmissionshelper.com. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about this very helpful website in a couple of minutes. This particular podcast, podcast number one, will define the play for the purposes of this series of podcasts, and it's also going to look at how plays are unique as narrative art forms, and I'm going to talk about some of the implications of those unique features for the playwright and things that you might think about when you're writing your own play. Before I get into that content, however, I'm going to take care of a couple of administrative details. Some of this administrative material is covered in more detail in the introductory podcast, but as a quick review, each of these podcasts has a learning aid or a handout that goes with it, and that learning aid can be downloaded from the Play Submissions Helper website in PDF form. The learning aid or the handout that goes with this podcast is called Podcast 1, What is a Play? And you can download it and print it out, and you'll be able to follow along with some of the key points of the podcast by looking at this handout if you like. I've already talked a little bit about who I am. Again, my name is Andrew Black, and I'm your learning host. But I want to spend a moment or two talking about Play Submissions Helper, which is the series sponsor. Play Submissions Helper is a community of more than 1,700 playwrights. And the goal is to help playwrights realize their dream of getting their plays produced. And they do this by providing a compendium online of hundreds of theaters that are accepting play submissions. And they have the theaters that are accepting submissions divided up into a variety of different formats, theaters that accept plays on an ongoing basis, theaters that have deadlines that you need to make sure you're keeping track of. It's actually a great system for a busy playwright who wants to focus on the craft of writing and doesn't want to have to spend a whole lot of time doing research on where to submit the work once it's complete. So now let's look at our agenda for today's podcast, What is a Play? And if you have the handout, you can look on page 3 of the handout and you'll see the overview of topics. So I've already done the startups, welcomed you, talked about the handout, who I am, and the sponsor. And the first topic I'm going to cover is, what are some of the characteristics of a well-made play? What are those defining characteristics? And as an extension of that, what types of narrative are most likely to benefit from the content in this podcast series? And then after I've talked about those defining characteristics, I'm going to talk a little bit about how writing for the theater, how writing a play is different than writing for other types of narrative, such as a movie or a poem or a book. And I'm going to talk about some of the implications for the playwright. And then after I've done that, I'm going to provide some assignments that you can take and execute if you're interested in deepening your understanding of the topics that are covered in this podcast. And those assignments are listed in your handout, and there's actually places you can write down answers or reflections that you have as you execute those assignments. So those are the topics that I'm going to be covering in the podcast today. So this brings us to our first topic, what is a play? And for the purposes of this discussion, I've identified 5 defining key characteristics of a well-made play. And if you have the handout, you can look on page 4 where I put together a table that is going to help you understand these 5 characteristics. And I have to say I struggled a little bit with this because I have a background in instructional design. And one of the first things that a good instructional designer does when he or she is approaching a topic is to define what the topic is. And I thought, well, this is kind of interesting in a way because everybody thinks they know what a play is. And yet it would probably be useful to define it for the podcast audience. What exactly are we talking about when we're talking about a play? And what I discovered is that it actually turned out to be a little harder than I thought it was going to be to say, well, what exactly is a play? So my working definitions here, my defining characteristics are work in progress for me. And I'm going to start with these ideas, and they'll help you understand a little bit about how I think about theater and how I think about playmaking. And I think that some of these ideas are going to stimulate your thinking and could potentially help you as well. In art, there are rarely firmly drawn lines. So it's important to start with that. And the principles that I'm going to be talking about apply to a variety of different kinds of narrative, not just theater, not just plays. So what I've decided to do is define these distinctions as a continuum with three broad categories. Something that definitely is a play, something that could potentially be a play, and something that is probably not a play. So I think that'll become clearer as I get into the content. So let's look at the first defining characteristics, characteristic of a play. The first characteristic for the purpose of this discussion is that it is text-based. A play has a script and is based primarily on written words or language. So I think most people would agree that a play is text-based. Now, it's probably not based on another form. Opera, ballet, dance, the circus, a music concert, cabaret are not really, strictly speaking, plays. They may tell stories. And Cirque du Soleil has a narrative. It's a circus, of course, but it does have a light narrative that holds the whole experience together. That does not make it a play just because it has a narrative. So all of those they're performance-based media. But that they're probably not plays. Now, the gray area in the middle, it would be text-based with music, which is like a musical. So I think most people would say that Oklahoma or Carousel or Spring Awakening are musical plays. They're text-based with music. So they're kind of a gray area there. So that's the first defining characteristic. The second defining characteristic of a play is it typically has a unified story with a beginning, a middle, and an end. And that story is revealed primarily through dialogue and character actions. So that, I think, helps to define what a play is. A beginning, a middle, and an end, and revelation of story through dialogue and character actions. At the other end of the continuum, you have narrative forms or forms, theatrical forms, really, that are like a collection of things. So it's like a review, a variety show, vaudeville would fall into this category, a magic show, light show, evening of skits. These are all theater, and these are frequently and usually, in fact, performed in a theater, but they're not really plays. So in the gray area in the middle, what could be a play but is not necessarily a play would be a series of short plays that are held together by a frame or a common theme. So there's a play called Almost Maine, which is a series of short stories, short plays, short stories, each with their own beginning and a middle and an end that have a common theme. They all take place in the same fictional town in Maine. So those, I'd say, that evening of theater is actually a play, although the entire evening doesn't necessarily have its own beginning and a middle and an end. So there's some gray area in there as well. The third defining characteristic is that a play is written to be performed live in front of an audience. At the other end of the continuum, things that are not plays, of course, movie scripts aren't plays. They're not designed to be produced or performed in front of an audience. They're written to be filmed and then shown in a movie theater. But other probably nots in this category are anything that's taken from another source and performed live in front of an audience without making any changes. So like poetry readings or even a reading of a novel out loud in front of an audience. While those are performed live in front of an audience, they were not written to be performed that way. So that is what keeps them from being plays. In the gray area, you have content that's taken from other sources and then is rewritten to be performed live in front of an audience. So like for instance, Reader's Theater is an art form that takes perhaps a short story and then reimagines it, and it's read exactly as it was written in front of a live audience with actors reading the different parts. So depending on how that's handled, it might or it might not be a play. The fourth defining characteristic is that a play could be any, could really be any length, a variety of length. So what that means, it could be a full-length play, like two acts or three acts. It could be one act, which is typically about 45 minutes or 60 minutes long. It could be a 10-minute play. It is probably not, however, a one-page. And there's more recently been a group of people who work in what they call the format of the one-minute play. I must confess, I'm a skeptic. I don't think you can tell a story that has a beginning, a middle, and an end in 1 minute. It's possible, but I think that it would be very, very, very challenging, and certainly not for the beginner. The fifth defining characteristic of the play is that it takes place in theatrical reality. It's fictional, it's illustrative, and it's usually metaphoric. So what is not a play is anything that is actual reality. And I'm going to put into this category like fact-based storytelling, docu-theater, found object theater, or a memoir, which is read out loud. So those are real stories about real things that happen to real people. They're not fictional, illustrative, or metaphoric. They're very, very, very literal. So in the gray area in the middle, something that could be a play is something that's based on or inspired by true events, but is edited or changed to meet the needs of theatrical performance. And a second category that could be but may not be is what I'm going to call artistic storytelling, where you take a real story and tell it in front of an audience, but you take artistic license with it to make it more theatrical and more interesting. So when I talk about what is a play, just to quickly review, I'm talking about an art form, a narrative art form that's text-based. It has a unified story with a beginning, a middle, and an end, where the story is revealed primarily through dialogue and character actions. It's written to be performed live in front of an audience. It could be a variety of lengths, and it takes place in theatrical reality. So those are the defining characteristics of a play as I think of them, and as I'm going to talk about them in this podcast series. So now that we've looked at the key characteristics of a play, I'm going to give you a couple of assignments, a couple of action learning projects. And if you look in your handout on page 5, you'll see those action learning projects described. And the first thing to do is to think back to some of your favorite theatrical experiences. And then refer to the table on page 4 and see if you can determine whether the theatrical experience you're thinking of fully meets the criteria for definitely being a play. And then write those below. Last night I went to see a musical which was based on the novel Jane Eyre by Charlotte Bronte. And it was definitely a play. It was clearly text-based. It was a unified story with a beginning, a middle, and an end. The story was revealed through dialogue and character actions. There was music, but the music forwarded the action and was very much a part of the story. It was obviously written to be performed in front of an audience, which loved it. It was a full length, and it was definitely theatrical reality. So that musical version of Jane Eyre by the wonderful playwright Paige Scott fits that those five defining characteristics. Another one of my favorite, I'm also going to ask you to think about some of your favorite evenings in the theater, which, while enjoyable, may not actually be a play. And I'm going to think back to my own experience. One of my favorite evenings in the theater was watching a performance by the Blue Man Group, which I've seen that a couple of times. I've seen their performance a couple of times in New York, and I loved it. It was transformative. But strictly speaking, it's not a play. It's not text-based. It doesn't have a beginning, a unified story with a beginning, a middle, and an end. It was clearly designed to be performed in front of a live audience. It's very theatrical. But strictly speaking, it doesn't meet the definition of a play. The second question asks you to look about the play that you're writing now or thinking about writing and asks you to consider whether that play meets the criteria for definitely as a play and to see where it may, if it falls into some of the maybe a play categories. And I'm also going to further ask you to think about whether there might be adjustments that need to be made to the way you think about your work in order to make it more clearly a play. So there's a little bit of reflection that you can do there. Again, those questions are on page 5 of your handout. Now let's turn our attention to the next topic, which is how is writing for the theater or writing a play different than writing for other forms of narrative? And if you want to look on page 6 of your handout, you'll see that I have 6 key areas where writing for the theater or writing a play is different than writing for other forms of narrative, such as writing for a movie or writing a novel or writing poetry or writing for anything that's not a play, right, where a story is told. So the 6 key characteristics are listed on page 6 of your handout. I'm not going to preview them for you. If you want to look ahead, you can see them. I'm just going to take them one at a time. So one key characteristic of writing for a play that makes it a very unique form of narrative is that a play is a story told which is told in front of a live audience. And the performer and the audience breathe the same air and exchange emotional energy. And I'm going to illustrate this point with a story about a production I saw recently. It was a 2-character play called Sex with Strangers. I saw it here in Indianapolis, and the actors, Angela Plank and Brandon Allstott, played the 2 leading characters, and they were actually quite good. So it was obvious that the female character played by Angela was the protagonist. And there was a scene in the play which involved the woman having forbidden the guy, and it was obvious that she was quite attracted to him, from reading a creative project that she had written. She asked him not to read it. Well, he went ahead and read it anyway. And when she found out, she confronted him, and he started to heap praise upon the work. So Angela, the actress, did an outstanding job of bringing to life the emotions that a woman in that position might have actually felt. So we got to the moment where she really listened to the other character and she experienced his praise, and it was obvious that she felt a bit insecure about the quality of her own work, and she showed genuine emotion. Now, I'm going to say I was sitting in the front row, so that helps, but there was no mistaking the feeling. The actress playing the woman was having the feelings of that fictional character. I mean, I could see the tears in her eyes, and I felt the feeling right along with her. Her sense of betrayal, her anger, her surprise, her joy. It was all right there in front of me in the same room, and it was really powerful. I succumbed to her world, and I felt her feelings. And to a certain extent, I was defenseless against them. This phenomenon of complete identification with character on the stage is really powerful. A psychologist or a neurologist might be able to explain what happens to us physiologically when we're in the presence of somebody else's emotions, how, like, what I would call an empathic reaction occurs. Or maybe I could call it an emotional energy transfer. It doesn't mean, just because we experience that emotional energy transfer in the theater, it doesn't mean we don't experience it in other places too. We can certainly experience it watching a movie. But I believe strongly that watching a movie where an actor demonstrates emotion is not the same as having a person experience an emotion in the same room with you. There's a level of vulnerability for that actor, and by transference for the audience, that doesn't happen in a movie theater in the same way. In our daily life, we're often insulated against authentic emotions. And frequently in social situations, if someone starts to cry or begins to tear up, there's almost an impulse to stop the person from having that emotion, as if it were some kind of a social faux pas that should be avoided at all costs. The only place that most people get to experience authentic emotions with others is in an intimate, familial situations. And sometimes even there, depending on the kind of family you come from, emotions are discouraged. In therapy groups, which people join for healing purposes, the open display of emotion is actually encouraged. And I think that one reason that people get into these groups is so they can get in touch with and experience emotions they can't experience in other places on a day-to-day basis. In the theater, when we watch a play, we get to observe people having authentic emotions, and we get to see what happens to them as they do. And part of our catharsis, part of the catharsis that takes place for us in the theater, is we get to experience the emotion along with the characters in the play. And the expression of this authentic emotion is part of what I would call a creative partnership between the playwright, the actor, and the director. other designers and artists may be involved as well. If there's a sound design, lighting may play into this and enhance the emotion. So there's a variety of people that get involved in creating this experience for the audience. But if the playwright has done his job or her job, the audience has a strong sense of identification with the character, which has been built over the course of the play leading up to that moment. So when the character experiences an emotion, we're already invested emotionally in that character, so we as an audience are ready to go. I also want to say, I think this is important for the playwright, is the moment has to be what I would call justified. Different audience members are going to have different emotional set points, and this is where art comes into play. The task is to create a character in a situation that an average audience member will identify with and believe in, so that when the emotional moment comes for the character, audience members let down their defenses against having emotions and experience the emotion along with the character. So if the audience members get to do this, they're experiencing one of the miracles of life theater. The story unfolds in front of them. They and the performer are breathing the same air and exchanging emotional energy. So that's one way that writing a play for the theater is different than writing for other kinds of narrative. Here's the second one. And it's actually somewhat related to the first one. There's a feedback loop between the audience and the actor. And the art product actually changes every time it is produced based on audience response. And I think that that sense of audience response in that feedback loop creates a really powerful sense of community among the people who are in the theater watching the play. Now, this phenomenon of this feedback loop is well known by people who work in the theater. It may not be as completely as well understood by people who go see plays. The performance that the audience sees is actually going to be different every night. There are many reasons for this ever-changing dimension, and the interaction between the audience and the performer is one of them. For many actors, this is actually one of the things that makes live theater so satisfying, is that they get to experience the reaction and the pleasure of the audience firsthand. They get to hear when the audience members applaud or laugh. They may cry. They may gasp in surprise. It's perhaps less entertaining for an actor when the audience members don't laugh at something that was supposed to be funny. They may shuffle in their seats with boredom. And then occasionally an audience member may fall asleep and begin to snore. But these mixed experiences are all part of the conversation between the performer and the audience member. And any experienced actor will tell you that the performance changes considerably when an audience is added to the mix. Most professional theaters have preview nights, which allow the actors to add the experience of working with an audience as part of their rehearsal process before the official opening of the play. The audience response gives the actors energy, and it usually will affect pace and intensity of the performance. Now, one obvious place where there's the conversation is with humor. I mean, the audience members either laugh at the joke or they don't, or they may laugh more or less intently. And there's a phrase in the theater, holding for laughs, which identifies the action that the actors take when the audience finds something amusing. The actors literally have to adjust their timing to the response of the audience. And this adjustment makes for a different experience every night. And if it's done correctly, it actually allows for an optimal experience, so the audience gets to hear every joke clearly. One of the things about watching a movie is that if the audience is laughing really loud, it may be hard to hear what the actors are saying in the movie in the theater, because the laughter will drown out the sound. In a theater, that should never happen, because the actors should be able to time the speaking of their dialogue to the audience response. So while the interactive nature of theater is obvious with comedy, it's actually equally true for other kinds of dramatic moments. An actor may sense the audience's anxiety over some kind of a bit that's happening on the stage, and they can extend a pause for a moment. And then minute moment-by-moment changes occur on stage as the experienced actor reads the energy of the audience and then responds to it. So this phenomenon makes the theater an interactive experience, where seeing a movie or reading a book reading a poem. Those are all passive experiences. The movie is going to play exactly the same way every night, regardless of how the audience responds. Now, in some plays, audience interactivity is literally built into the experience, so the audience member becomes a kind of character. This particular device was used in the musical Putnam County Spelling Bee, where audience members are literally brought on stage and they appear as contestants. There's another play called The Night of January 16th, which is a courtroom drama by Ayn Rand. And it begins with jurors being selected from the audience to sit on stage, and they actually render a verdict at the end of the piece. So every night there's a new jury, there's new interaction between fictional characters and real life people, and the potential exists for there to be one of multiple verdicts each night, depending on how the audience members in the jury box interpret the play. Now, usually the audience is only subconsciously aware of this conversation that goes on. So, sometimes it can burst into full view. And the Stephen Sondheim musical Into the Woods was filmed as a DVD with its original Broadway cast. And the actress Joanna Gleason appeared in her Tony Award-winning role as the baker's wife. So in the second act, she sings a song which is titled Moments in the Woods. And if you watch the DVD carefully, it's very obvious that Joanna Gleason made a calculation about how long she needed to wait for the audience to finish applauding before she went to her next line. So she starts to go to her next line, and then she realizes that she misjudged. So the ovation continues, and then Joanna Gleason has to wait longer than she anticipated. And in a certain way, the audience was holding this actor hostage to their wish to continue applauding her performance. So in this way, a very particular and special kind of community is created in the theater. People have gotten dressed up, left their homes, bought a ticket, and they're all sitting in the theater together. And that experience alone, of course, creates a certain kind of community. But the audience as a group gets to determine to a certain extent how the event unfolds based on their collective response. And a sense of community, of course, can develop in a movie theater. And yet, the response of the audience is going to have no impact on the way the movie unfolds. One last note that's relevant here. I'm going to talk a little bit about film versus plays in the theater. Is that film is a director's medium. So the director controls the audience's point of view through the use of camera angles, such as the close-up. And the director can direct the audience's attention to the part of the story that he wants them to look at any given moment. In the theater, the point of view is left entirely up to the audience. While the director may focus the audience's attention via the use of lighting or a creative tableau, where the audience looks on the stage is left up to the individual audience member. So the audience has the ability to manage their own focus based on where they want to look, and that's another thing that makes live theater a more interactive medium. Thus, the opportunity exists for the playwright to create special moments where the audience gets to laugh, cry, boo, hiss, or gasp in surprise, and then have a shared experience together. The audience knows that it's participating in an interactive ritual, and the playwright, of course, is the one who starts that ritual and starts that conversation. One additional thing that makes writing a play for the theater different than writing for other forms of narrative is that an audience in a theater watching a play gets to see something happening that it knows will never happen again in the same way. Now, this is somewhat related to the topic that I just talked about, which is the feedback loop between the audience and actor. That feedback loop is actually one of the things that creates an experience that the audience realizes will never happen again in exactly the same way. But there are other factors that influence that experience. And so I thought this topic deserved a special discussion all of its own. The fact is that any kind of live performance, if you go to see a concert, for instance, you're going to see something that will never be repeated in exactly the same way. I'll just quickly say that I had the experience of seeing the same concert two nights in a row. The performer was Bette Midler. I saw her perform in Berkeley at the Berkeley Community Center two nights in a row. And she sang a song on the second night that she didn't sing on the first night. So in this case, the concert was early in the tour and she was trying out some different kinds of material. But I definitely saw something on the second night that I didn't see on the first. Audience members who go to a preview of a play frequently see a very different play than an audience will see later in the run, when the bugs have been worked out and the team has matured in its mastery of the content and the process. And in some cases, actual changes to the text may be made during the run. Plays that build in interactive elements or audience participation elements leverage this awareness because the audience frequently delights in the fact that what they see happening tonight won't happen in the same way ever again. Different people's names are going to be called from the stage. Different people in the audience will be spoken to or made fun of. And of course, some nights of audience participation are just funnier than others, depending on who the audience members are. Sometimes there are, by intention, very special nights in the theater. A great person may have passed away, and the audience may be asked to observe a moment of silence before the show begins. There may be a dancer in the show who makes a marriage proposal to one of his or her castmates during the curtain call. There may be a great lady of the theater who's having her final performance, and there might be a moving tribute to her or little jokes throughout the actual performance of the play. These experiences can indelibly enshrine a theatrical experience in the mind of an audience member. Once I saw a performance of the musical A Little Shop of Horrors on Broadway, and one of the understudies went on unexpectedly. So the announcement was made at the top of the show, and all eyes were on the trio of African-American women who play Crystal, Ronette, and Chiffon, because one of them was the understudy going on for the normal performer. And at the end of the show, there was a lovely tribute to that woman who stepped in and did such an excellent job. So in the theater, this is a moment that an audience member will never forget. Another fact about seeing a play in the theater is that theaters have a fixed seating capacity, and it's usually a small number. A theater can only admit so many people, so there's a limit to the number of the people who can literally be in the room. For popular shows, this limitation adds to the mystique of the performance. So the experience of seeing the hot show or maybe the popular TV star on stage is limited just to those few who were lucky enough to get tickets. And no one else is going to be able to see that performance live. I had the experience of seeing the musical The Producers with the original cast members Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick when it was the big musical on Broadway. And the reason I'd gotten tickets is because I knew somebody who knew somebody. So not only did we get in when nobody else was getting in, but we actually had really great house seats. And I have to say, the air in the theater before the show was electric. It was hard to escape the idea that we were like the chosen few. We were about to see something on that stage that very few people were ever going to get to see. And there are some performances or productions that cast a spell over the audience members who see them. I can still recall the experience of seeing the movie star, Hugh Jackman, on Broadway in The Boy from Oz. It was a terrific performance. I got to see it, and very few people did, and no one is going to get to see it exactly the same way ever again. So productions of a play have a lifespan, and when the show closes, it's over. DVDs rarely, if ever, capture the magic of that live performance. So astute audience members savor this unique experience, and they're on the lookout for those special moments. When I taught theater appreciation, part of my assignment to my students who attended plays and wrote papers on them, they were asked to be on the lookout for something that happened during the performance that they saw that would never be repeated exactly the same way ever again. And they could always find something. One more thing about plays in the theater that make them somewhat unique is that they unfold in real time. And as a result, anything can happen in live theater. And to a certain extent, all of the bugs have not been completely worked out. And if you're following along in the handout, I'm now at item D. This characteristic has become kind of a cliche. Something goes horribly wrong in a public forum and the character shrugs his shoulders and says, you gotta love live theater. And the fact of the matter is that in live theater, almost anything can happen. There's an opportunity for goofs in the theater of the kind that would never happen in a movie. Now, of course, there may be continuity errors in movies, but the potential for the unexpected in the theater is exponentially higher. And that justifies making it a standalone item in this discussion of differences between writing for the theater and writing for other forms of narrative. The things that can happen on stage are numerous. An actor may forget his lines, a light cue or a sound cue goes wrong, a prop is missing, someone falls down, a performer loses her voice. In the world of movie making, the director would just call cut and the shoot would start over. DVD versions of movies now feature gag reels of the flubs. Those moments, which of course are almost always omitted from the final film. Movies are a world of perfection where everything goes as planned, everything is tightly controlled and executed. And the same thing is usually true for, of course, for a book or a poem. I mean, it's scrupulously edited, it's bound, it's ready to go. There is no mistakes in the book. This is not so in the theater, which is part of its power. And Elaine Stritch did a one-woman show called At Liberty, and she told the story of an actor who was playing a character sitting at a breakfast table, and the character was preparing to murder his wife with a gun, which the prop man was to have preset under the table. So in this story, the actor goes to reach for the prop, and it wasn't there. So the actor jumped up, grabbed a bowl of jelly, which was on the table, and announced that he was going to kill his wife with a bowl of poison jelly. Oops. In an evening of theater that I produced, a married actor was playing a character who was supposed to be single, and a comment was made about his lack of a wedding ring. Unfortunately, that actor had forgotten to remove his own wedding ring, and he had to act rather unsuccessfully around his own mistake. So anything can happen. And part of the fun or the thrill of live theater is knowing that the performers are, in a sense, performing without a net. I recall seeing an outdoor theater performance of the musical Promises. And at one point, an airplane flew overhead very noisily. So the leading actor, who was a TV actor named Michael Callan, was supposedly standing in a hallway outside an apartment on stage. So he looked up as the airplane flew over the entire audience, and he said, "We've got to get that hole in the ceiling fixed." So it was an ad lib, and the audience roared its approval. And these are the kinds of experiences that make going to the theater really fun and really special. And most aficionados of live theater have their own favorite story along these lines. Another aspect of the experience, which is part of the thrill and part of what commands our respect in the theater, is that it does unfold in real time. So there's no cutting away from the action. There's no camera tricks that can deceive the audience. We know the actors have memorized every word. We know the dancers executed every step. Each and every aspect of the performance happened in front of us, and we saw it happen. That doesn't mean there's no stagecraft. You know, there still can be trapdoors, which can allow an actor to disappear. And there can be specialized lifts and guy wires that hold Peter Pan aloft during the flying sequence. A pre-recorded soundtrack may double for someone playing the piano. But in general, live theater presents a set of constraints that the director, the artistic staff, and the actors have to work within. And within those constraints, what you see is what you get. The fact that the performance unfolds within these constraints in real time is part of what makes live theater so thrilling. Now, most of the differences that I've talked about so far in these podcasts have to do with artistic differences. I'm going to shift my perspective for the last two items and talk a little bit more about the business of theater as opposed to its art. So let's shift our focus and look at a couple of more differences between telling a story on the stage in a theater and telling a story in other forms of narrative. So the next significant difference between writing for the theater, writing a play for the theater, and writing for other forms is that most other forms cost a great deal to produce and distribute. Theater projects can actually be mounted on a relative shoestring. And I talk about movies. I'm going to compare and contrast movies with the theater primarily in this section, although many of the things I'm saying apply to other forms as well. According to one source, an average movie can be produced for $139 million. This average consolidates films with small independent movies with smaller budgets and big Hollywood blockbusters. And that figure is just the production cost. The marketing budget for a Hollywood film can add many additional millions to the project. So most theaters would love to have the table scraps that might fall from the kind of budget meal that I just described with those numbers. The world of the theater is the world of tight budgets. There are exceptions, of course, but not very many. Most theaters are in fact nonprofit status. They've been granted 501c3 status by the federal government and the Internal Revenue Service. Nonprofit status is granted to organizations which provide services which exist to primarily enhance the common good, and they therefore need a little help to survive financially. Nonprofit organizations usually work on tight budgets. They're usually revenue neutral, which means they make as much as they spend, and they can actually raise money via private or corporate donations to supplement their earnings. And the people who give money to nonprofits like theaters deduct the contributions from their incomes, from their income taxes rather, because contributing to those nonprofits is like a financial good deed. The fact is that many people, and in fact, people who run theaters believe this too, unfortunately, believe that theaters are self-supporting through ticket sales. A healthier mix for a theater is that about 40% of its operating budget comes from ticket sales, and the rest has to come from other sources like grants, donations, sales of other products such as t-shirts or maybe fundraisers where admission is paid. Many theaters operate on a shoestring, and some may actually be teetering on the brink of financial disaster from show to show or from season to season. Specific budgets, of course, are going to vary from theater to theater, depending on whether the theater is a community-style theater, which is staffed by volunteers, a larger theater that has a paid staff, or a professional equity house where theater is a real business. In general, however, the costs of putting on a play are minuscule compared to that of making a movie. This seemingly sad state of affairs contains the seeds of opportunity for the writer of play scripts, however. I mean, it's possible to carry around a screenplay for years or have a novel, hoping to find someone to invest large amounts of money to make it a reality or to find a publisher who's going to promote it for you. Getting a play produced is much easier by comparison because the level of financial risk is quite small. It really takes very little financially to get a play on its feet. For small venues, the two most expensive outright costs are the cost of the venue, which is renting the space, and the cost of the royalties, or the licensing fees for the script. If the venue is donated, like a church basement, and the play is original, the writer may waive his or her fees, since getting the plays produced may be reward enough. The two biggest cost factors are eliminated. A group of actors who are willing to work for a percentage of the door, costumes provided out of their wardrobes, props made in someone's basement, and voila, the show can open. This opportunity has implications for the playwright, of course. A limited production budget, by definition, limits the kinds of things that can be done on the stage and the relative quality that will be available. The good news is that a talented director and production staff can find theatrical solutions which in some ways are more effective than the real thing. The greatest tool the playwright has is the imagination of the audience, and the audience will suspend its belief and accept theatrical conventions. Cubes and coffin blocks can stand in for furniture, and if the actors believe it, it will be believed in the mind of the audience as well. If you know you may be writing for these kinds of theaters, then you have to stay flexible in the way you think about your work as a writer. You know, particularly when you get your first production, workarounds may be required. Go for it. Learn from the production, be glad you have it, and then prep for the next one where hopefully the production budget will be slightly higher. The relatively low cost of mounting a theatrical production has one more implication for the writer as well. You know, high-budget projects are rarely going to tackle controversial, innovative, or experimental ideas. The amount of money riding on the enterprise limits risk-taking. The theater, on the other hand, is a place where edgy, dark, unusual ideas can flourish and either succeed or fail. Movies have to hire writers and directors with a proven track record of success. The low cost of the theater allows production teams to take risks on new works by unknown writers. If the theater has a full season, it can balance one or two risky items with a couple of known crowd pleasers to help balance the budget. Therefore, the theater is a great forum for ideas and voices that may be new or different. Many stories dealing with the issues of minority or different characters are mounted on the stage first before breaking into mainstream media. Stories about gay people, African Americans, women, other various diverse or marginalized populations have been produced first on the stage. It's an excellent and inexpensive forum for providing these unusual narratives to unfold. If the stars align, some of these stories may break out to the next level, larger theaters, or a movie deal. Tyler Perry started his work as a writer, writing plays about African-American characters on the stage, and then later crossed over to films, where he became successful as a writer and a director. Therefore, this difference, which may at first look like a problem, contains the seeds of an opportunity for the writer to get the work out and see it performed in front of an appreciative audience, an opportunity the writers and other mediums may have to wait a long time for. The last key difference between writing a play for the theater and writing for other formats, particularly writing a screenplay for a movie, is that theater is a very flexible medium. Playwrights can write and rewrite until they get it right. Once movies have been shot, however, very little can be done about them. This item is, in a way, the most personal to me. I have a degree in radio and TV, and I spent much of my career writing scripts for corporate training programs. I know how to write a screenplay, and I decided at a certain point that I wanted to do more creative kinds of writing, and I decided to write a screenplay for a commercial movie. My idea was to make a 5-minute movie featuring gay characters, and then I was going to take it out on the gay and lesbian film festival circuit and see if I could generate interest in myself as a commercial filmmaker. Now, in theory, this isn't a bad idea. I had contacts in the media, I leveraged them to get some equipment donated, and I rounded up some actors. And my plan was to shoot a down and dirty version of my screenplay and then use it to see if I could generate financing for my short movie. I did a whole rough cut version of my film in a single day. I worked with an editor to create a final draft that I could show people. When we were done, I looked at what I had and I completely hated it. I thought it was boring, it didn't move. I didn't think I'd really be able to do anything with it. I certainly didn't think I was going to be able to use it to raise any money. Now, in retrospect, I see that part of the problem was my own lack of experience with making movies to entertain. I now believe that if I'd refocused and studied and applied myself, I might have been able to figure out how to take that idea and put it together in a way that it would have been entertaining and even compelling. But the footage that I shot seemed irredeemable to me. I didn't think I'd be able to do anything with it, and this fact illustrates the final difference between writing for the theater and writing for some other media. It's quite easy for a playwright to test the effectiveness of the writing. All you have to do is invite a few friends over to your house and have the thing read out loud. If they laugh at the right places and cry at the end, you're on to something. If they don't, well, as soon as they leave, you can start rewriting. The dynamic nature of the medium allows the creative artist to make changes quickly and to test them almost as quickly. The implications for the writer of plays is clear. Leverage the flexibility of the form to test, retest, and then make changes. A maxim of creative writing is that writing is rewriting, and playwrights need to take advantage of those opportunities to develop their work by having readings, testing, and then rewriting. This idea can be challenging, especially if the writer has a strong ego. After I wrote my first play, I was told I was going to need to rewrite the second act. I was crestfallen because, you know, I thought the whole thing was perfect. Since I had written that play with a collaborator, Patricia Milton was her name, she had no such ego and more realistic expectations. She was like, okay, well, let's do it. So we did. And shortly after that, we had a new and a much better second act. Writers need to take advantage of the dynamic nature of the medium. If I like, I can get actors, or anybody really, together to hear just the first 10 pages of my play. Now, since the first 10 pages are critical to the success of the rest of the work, a reading of the opening scene can tell me a lot. Now, it would be very unusual to shoot the first 10 pages of a movie as a way of testing whether it worked or not for many reasons. So in addition, as a writer, I like the positive reinforcement of hearing my work read. And hearing the first 10 pages read provides me with a positive incentive to actually write the second 10 pages. If you're taking a class or a workshop, that setting usually provides great opportunities for you to hear your work, get critiques, and then keep moving. When your play is complete, a table read will help you spot what is working and where there may be problems. With a table read, the whole work is read from beginning to end without a stop, and someone reads the stage directions to help the audience members figure out what's going on when there's no dialogue. And then there's a discussion after. Then after the discussion, the playwright can sit down and do rewrites. At a later stage of development, the writer may assemble a small production team for a staged reading where stage movement and actor prep are added to the process. Even in production, changes can be made in rehearsal or during the actual run. When a new play of mine is in production, I attend rehearsals and I make changes to the text as I need to. The concept of out-of-town tryouts is part of the process for getting a show ready to open on Broadway, where the play is tested in smaller, less risky venues like New Haven, Connecticut. Changes can be made as needed to strengthen the play to get it ready for the opening. And in some well-documented cases, plays have been completely rewritten after the play has opened. In fact, some plays have even been rewritten years after the original opening, for instance, to update cultural references. The musical On a Clear Day You Can See Forever changed the sex of one of its main characters and made other changes to try to update the plot to appeal to a new generation of audiences. For the playwright, again, this difference is a blessing, although it can seem like a curse. At a certain point, the writer has to say it's finished and let it go. With movies, of course, actors can be called back and additional scenes can be shot for a final version. The film can be re-edited. However, these situations are the exception rather than the rule. Play scripts give the narrative writer a unique opportunity to tinker, make changes, and develop the work, and playwrights need to take advantage of that opportunity. So in this last section of the podcast, I've talked about how writing for the theater is different for writing for other media. And I've given you six different characteristics that distinguish writing a play from writing for other narrative forms. So if you want to look on page 6 of your handout, you'll see there are some exercises that are going to give you the opportunity to deepen your own understanding of these concepts. So let me quickly go through those. Number one, I'm going to ask if you've ever noticed the impact it has on you when actors demonstrate emotion while they're in the same room with you. And if you haven't noticed that, I'm going to encourage you to go to a small theater and notice the way you respond to the actor's emotions. Number two, I'm going to ask if you can recall a time when the reaction of the audience had an impact on the performance of the play. What was it? If you can't recall a time, you should go to see a play and observe how a small audience reaction, such as laughter or silence, might impact the performance and the actors. I'm also asking here if you recall a time when the crowd and the audience began to feel like a community, and I'm going to ask what happened to create that sense of community in the audience. On page 7, the third question, the third action learning project, is to recall whether you've had the experience of watching something in a theater that was totally unique to that performance, something that you knew would never happen in the same way exactly again. And then any play that involves audience interaction would fall into that category. What kind of effect did that have on you as an audience member? Action learning project number 4 is to recall a time when you saw a play and something didn't go the way that it was supposed to. A prop was missing, the actor missed a line, something. What impact did that have on you? Question 5, have you ever watched an actor or an ensemble perform in a way that made you think, wow, where there was some feat of skill or talent or craft which was impressive due to its raw power, and getting to see it unfold in real time made it all that much more impressive? What was that skill or that talent or that craft? On page 8, question number 6 is to ask if you've ever been to a small community theater where the production was mounted on what might be called a shoestring. And if you haven't, then you should go see one. And notice what works about the production, particularly given the fact that the production has a small production budget. How is this story brought to life effectively through theatrical techniques or other imaginative solutions to the fact that the theater company has a small budget? And the last action learning project is question 7 on page 8. If you have a script that you're working on, which hopefully you do if you're a playwright, see if you can put together a reading of some of what you have and see what you can learn from it. Keep it simple, just a few friends. Have some bottles of water available, make some copies of a few pages, and get your work read. And then have a discussion after and see what people say. What happens? How was the experience? What did you learn? And then you can begin your rewrite. So thanks for listening to Podcast One, What is a Play? This is Andy Black, playwright and learning host, thanking you for your kind attention. I hope you got something out of this podcast, and I look forward to seeing you when we launch into podcast number two, Generating the Idea. And a great big thank you to our series sponsor, the Play Submissions Helper, www.playsubmissionshelper.com. Thanks to everyone, and we'll see you next time.